Thank you, and good afternoon, and thanks to all of you who've joined us today for our webinar on recent regulatory developments impacting small dollar lending and small dollar credit products. I'm Jeremy Newell. I'm a partner here at Covington in our financial services group, where I focus on financial services regulation, and I'm very happy to be joined by my colleague, Eric Mogilnicki, also in the financial services group here at Covington, and an expert on, among other things, consumer financial services regulation and enforcement matters. Today's session is part of our weekly financial services teleconference series entitled Taking Stock, the Financial Services and Regulatory Landscape Today. And indeed, today is our 13th session in the weekly series. We've got two more coming, one on the CARES Act and another on developments in the enforcement environment in the coming weeks. And we've been very pleased to be able to continue to offer this series to our friends and to our clients. And we certainly hope it continues to be a helpful resource to all of you as we all seek to stay abreast of key developments in what's become a largely virtual COVID-19 professional development environment. Before we start, just two quick housekeeping items that I'll mention. The first is that for those of you that are interested in CLE credit, today's half-hour program is approved for 0.5 credits, both in New York and California. There are affirmation forms that were linked in the reminder notice you received for today's calls, and you'll need to record the affirmation code that I'm going to read towards the bottom of the half-hour near the end of the call, and return that form to our colleague, Elizabeth Cristiani. Her information is on the form, and she'll revert with a certificate of attendance to each of you in due course. Second, of course, we would welcome any questions that you may have during the program today. Please forward any questions that you might have to Al McManus at amcmanus@cov.com. And I'll spell that. It's amcmanus@cov.com. And we'll try to answer as many questions as we can during the half hour, but also obviously would be quite pleased to connect individually with any of you following the presentation, so don't hesitate to reach out. With those preliminaries aside, let's go ahead and dive in. Again, it's our pleasure this afternoon to provide a briefing that's focused on recent developments related to small dollar lending and small dollar credit products, including recent guidance that was issued by the federal banking agencies to encourage depository institutions to make small dollar loans, and provide some further insight in terms of how those agencies think about that activity, as well as a recent and quite interesting no action letter template that was issued by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to the Bank Policy Institute that directly addressed certain kinds of small dollar credit products. As many of you know, the regulatory environment as it relates to small dollar lending, both by banks and non-banks, has been subject to a pretty high-profile and dynamic public policy debate. I know Eric in a few minutes will talk a little bit more about that. And one major legacy of that debate has been a fair amount of regulatory uncertainty for participants in the marketplace regarding precisely how both the CFPB and the federal banking agencies, as well as other authorities, view these products, both from a consumer financial protection perspective, but also from a safety and soundness perspective. And indeed, that policy debate's only got more important over time, particularly as we've seen in recent years, innovation in financial services that's created new and novel approaches to underwriting and servicing and otherwise supporting small dollar loans that historically may not have been possible. So, although still, I think, an area of substantial complexity and expectations that continue to evolve, I do think it's fair to say that in recent months, we've at least seen some developments that taken together provide a better sense of how the current regulators are likely to think about and approach small dollar lending generally, and indeed may provide something of a roadmap towards greater regulatory certainty about what constitutes safe and responsible small dollar credit practices. In terms of what we'll cover, Eric and I are going to try to give you a high-level overview of these recent developments organized across two broad categories. First, Eric is going to provide a bit of historical background describing how it is we got to where we are today, and also walk through more specifically the recent interagency principles that were issued by the federal banking agencies on this topic. And then second afterwards, I'll talk more specifically about the Bank Policy Institute's recent application to the CFPB and the no action letter template that they were issued under that application. So with that as background, let me go ahead and turn things over to Eric to go through our first topic.
Thanks very much, Jimmy. To try to put current developments in historical context, I really should start in ancient Babylonia in 1750 BC, when the Code of Hammurabi prohibited charging interest. The time is short, so let me jump forward about 2,000 years when Psalm in the Old Testament explains that good will come to those who are generous and lend freely. But even then might be too far back, so let me skip forward another 2,000 years. What I think those historical sites indicate is that we have been grappling with what's fair in a world where some people have money and other people want to borrow it for a terribly long time. In the U.S., the regulatory pendulum has swung repeatedly between the goal of expanding the market so that more consumers have access to small dollar loans and the goal of erecting at least some guardrails that restrict access in the name of consumer protection. What's new, what we'll focus on today, is that the changes, the movements of that pendulum now occur not once in a generation, but once every few years. For many years, state laws predominated until the Supreme Court's ruling in Marquette National Bank in 1978 that a national bank may charge the interest rate allowed in the state where it's located, regardless of the borrower's location. That led by the 1990s to bank-based small dollar lending in the form of deposit advance products, or DAPs. These were small dollar loans, but while the traditional payday loans were made out of a storefront and included a definitive due date, DAPs were generally offered only to bank customers and would be paid off as soon as the borrower had money, as evidenced by the next electronic deposit in the customer's account. DAPs had their day, but were effectively killed by the OCC and the FDIC in 2013, not by a rule banning them, but by supervisory guidance that described the agency's expectations for deposit advance products. Suffice to say, those expectations were robust, including expecting that the bank would thoroughly evaluate the borrower's ability to repay. And there was little doubt that such products would face intense scrutiny from the regulators going forward. And accordingly, DAPs, though not prohibited, disappeared. The demand for small dollar loans, though, did not disappear. And so small dollar credit became more fully centered on non-bank lenders and eventually to online lenders. This created a special role for the CFPB, which had been explicitly assigned the regulation of payday lending in the Dodd-Frank Act. The Bureau between 2013 and 2016 issued no fewer than six white papers, ending with a proposed regulation of small dollar lending, which became final, but not effective yet, in early October 2017, just before Director Richard Cordray left the Bureau. That rule established ability to repay standards for small dollar loans and a series of requirements on how payments could be obtained. And in some ways, this rule was a replay of the DAP guidance. Payday loans were not banned outright, but the combination of requiring an ability to repay analysis, combined with the certainty of intense scrutiny by the Bureau in examinations and otherwise, seemed likely to do for payday loans what the DAP guidance did for DAPs. However, this rule's never been effective, thanks to ongoing litigation and new management at the Bureau, which agreed to a series of stays to the rule's effective date in the litigation and proposed a new rule that would repeal the repayment standards in the final but not yet effective rule. The latest turn in that twisty road is that the new rule, rescinding part of the payday rule, was due to be finalized in April 2020, but was stopped in its tracks, apparently by a New York Times article outlining alleged irregularities in the way it was shaped. While the Bureau's been in limbo, the bank regulatory agencies, the prudential regulatory agencies, have acted this time, this turn of the pendulum, to expand access to small dollar loans, in contrast to the Bureau's payday rule. The effort began with OCC guidance in 2018 on core lending principles for short-term small dollar installment lending. But that effort was superseded by a more detailed and coordinated approach on May 20th this year when the Fed, the FDIC, the National Credit Union Administration, and the OCC issued interagency guidance principles to encourage small dollar loans to consumers and small business, and to, not coincidentally, address some of the regulatory uncertainty that Jeremy mentioned at the top of this this presentation. The interagency statement recognized, I'm quoting here, the important role that responsibly offered small dollar loans can play in helping customers meet their ongoing needs for credit, from temporary cash flow imbalances, unexpected expenses, or income shortfalls, including during periods of economic stress, natural disasters, or other extraordinary circumstances, such as the public health emergency created by COVID-19. The principles are therefore intended to encourage, I'm not quoting them, to encourage supervised banks, savings associations, and credit unions to offer responsible small dollar loans to consumers for consumer and small business purposes. The principles cover a broad range of small dollar credit products, including both open-end lines of credit with applicable minimum payments, closed-end loans with shorter-term single payment or longer-term installment payment structures. They start, and I'm going to go into some detail on these principles, which are important. The lending principles start by identifying three characteristics of responsible small dollar loan programs: a high percentage of customers successfully repaying their loans, repayment terms and features that minimize rollovers or reborrowing, and repayment outcomes and program structures that enhance a borrower's financial capabilities going forward. The agencies then identify three core lending principles for depository institutions that offer small dollar loan products. First, loan product should be consistent with safe and sound banking, treat customers fairly, and comply with applicable laws and regulations. Second, depository institutions should effectively manage the credit, operational compliance, and other risks associated with the products that they offer. Third, loan products should be underwritten based on prudent policies and practices governing the amounts borrowed, the frequency of borrowing, and repayment requirements. The agencies also emphasize the importance of policies and risk management practices that permit a depository institution to identify, monitor, manage, and control the risks posed by responsible small dollar lending programs. And they set out five areas that should be of concern to each institution offering such loans. Loan structures should align with underwriting criteria while supporting borrower affordability and successful repayment rather than reborrowing. Loan pricing should reflect overall returns reasonably related to the financial institution's product risks and costs. Note that the principles do not include any specific limits or caps on interest rates, fees, or other pricing elements. Loan underwriting may use a wide range of internal and external data sources, and specifically that the agencies acknowledge deposit account activity, the basis of so-called cash flow underwriting, as such an appropriate source. Loan marketing and disclosures must not only comply with applicable consumer protection laws, but also provide information in a clear, conspicuous, accurate, and customer-friendly manner. Last, loan servicing should be handled in a manner that avoids continuous cycles of debt and significant credit costs due to rollover or reborrowing. This includes appropriate workout and restructuring strategies. Two more notes on the lending principles. One is, as I noted, they contemplate a range of different approaches to developing a responsible small dollar lending program and appear to contemplate, if not fully embrace, the use of artificial intelligence and alternative data, either directly or through well-managed third-party relationships. The last note is the lending principles also note that depository institutions may, but are not required to, discuss plans for small dollar loan products with the relevant agency before implementation, particularly when they might involve substantial deviations from existing business plans. So those are the principles. A few observations about them. First of all, you may have noted that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has not signed on to these. We assume that's because they are waiting to release their revision to the payday rule. But in a world of regulatory uncertainty, it's particularly important that the Bureau eventually sign on to these principles because they, after all, have the lead on consumer protection in this area and are also, as the rule itself indicates, capable of quickly changing positions. So you really want to be sure they're on board before relying upon these interagency principles. The other big picture observation I want to be sure to make is that there is still some wishful thinking in the policy. As I said at the top, there's long been a debate over how you manage the trade-off between improving access to loans and improving the affordability of loans. The policy statement punts on this issue. It encourages short-term loans that are made to consumers who need them, affordable, and consistent with existing safety and soundness standards. In reality, it's easy to meet any two of those goals, but only by sacrificing a third. For example, making small dollar loans that are affordable and broadly available creates a safety and soundness risk because the low cost won't cover the losses from defaults. Conversely, a bank can avoid safety and soundness risk by either restricting access to loans to reduce defaults or by increasing the cost of loans to cover the cost of defaults. But the principles don't acknowledge, much less resolve, the tension between the regulator's goals of accessibility, affordability, and safety and soundness. In light of that criticism, it's worth noting that two of the principles, better disclosure and forgiveness policies, offer concrete ways to improve customer and bank outcomes at the same time. These are not a zero-sum game. And so you may want to have those at the forefront of your planning for a short-term or small-dollar loan program. Speaking of planning, let me turn back to Jeremy to talk about one way forward in this space.
Great. Thanks, Eric. Indeed, as I alluded to, I'll spend the last 10 minutes or so of the presentation summarizing that potential path forward, which is a function of a recent no-action letter template that was issued by the CFPB to the Bank Policy Institute, which is a trade association representing the 40 or so largest banks active in the United States. I think the first interesting thing to note is the timing. That no action letter template was issued by the CFPB on May 22nd, just 2 days after the banking agencies had issued the interagency principles that Eric just walked through. And so I think it's probably fair to say that, you know, this can be viewed as part of a larger coordinated effort amongst the various agencies, both to encourage these products and to, you know, provide some further insight in terms of how the regulators are thinking about these products and the key issues that they might raise. In a nutshell, the no action letter template issued by the CFPB provides at least potentially a new mechanism by which depository institutions can obtain a no action letter from the CFPB under the template. And in a moment, I'll sort of explain how that will work. That will address the application of the Dodd-Frank Act prohibition on unfair, deceptive, and abusive acts or practices, also known as UDAP, to particular described aspects of the small dollar lending products that a financial institution might want to offer. And so the CFPB's issuance of the no action letter template, you know, could potentially provide depository institutions that want to offer these kinds of products with a new and expedited path to address, you know, what has otherwise been quite considerable regulatory uncertainty and regulatory risk associated with these products. Again, particularly when it comes to the UDAP analysis of the features of these products. And then I also think it's equally interesting, even for institutions that don't go that route, that don't formally pursue a no action letter under the template. You know, I think nonetheless, the template itself provides an interesting and relatively detailed look at how the CFPB may be likely to view this this type of product, again, especially from the perspective of a UDAP analysis. And that I think can be useful insight, again, even for depository institutions that don't pursue their own no action letter or for any other kind of financial institution that might be engaged in this type of activity. Let me, before talking about the template itself, just spend a few minutes on the legal framework that the CFPB has put in place for no action letters, because sort of key to the way that this all works. The no action letter template was issued pursuant to the CFPB's 2019 policy on no action letters, which itself was a substantial revision to an earlier version of the CFPB no action letter policy. That policy provides a general framework to reduce regulatory uncertainty with respect to innovative products and services through ultimately, in the form of a no action letter, a statement that the CFPB will not make supervisory findings or bring a supervisory or enforcement action against a company for offering particular described aspects of a product or service that are subject to the no action letter itself. I do think that latter language is important to emphasize. Again, under the policy, each no action letter has a limited scope. So it only applies to the described aspects of the product or service in question. So, you know, not sort of a broad, unlimited pass. The other thing about the policy and very pertinent here is that in the 2019 revisions, it not only provides a process for individual financial institutions to seek and obtain their own no action letters. It also permits certain kinds of third parties, including a trade association, to seek what is known as a no action letter template, pursuant to which the Bureau states its intention to grant subsequent applications for no action letters in appropriate cases where the applicant provides a combination of specific certifications and other kinds of supplemental information, which are specified in the template. So although a no action letter template, you know, is not itself independently binding, it does provide a pretty unique mechanism and path to clarify and expedite the issuance of binding no action letters to individual institutions down the road that wish to offer products or services, you know, consistent with the scope of the no action letter template. And again, I think it's just important to understand that general framework here, because that's the framework that the CFPB operated in issuing the no action letter template to BPI. Turning now to the actual no action letter template, and again, this was in response to an application filed by the Bank Policy Institute. That application and the no action letter template generally address a somewhat standardized small dollar loan product that is the subject of the template. It contemplates a loan that is generally small dollar in nature, which is to say for $2,500 or less, structured either as an installment loan or as a line of credit. It must be linked to a borrower's deposit account if the institution that would apply for a no action letter under this template. It's underwritten based on criteria that include the borrower's transaction activity in his or her account. So again, that's the cash flow underwriting that Eric alluded to a little while ago. And then it's also subject to a range of very specific protections with respect to repayment structures, mitigating rollover risk, and certain kind of fees, which I'll describe here in just a moment. Importantly, although there are certain sort of mandatory prescriptive features that are the subject of the no action letter template, it leaves open a fairly wide range of other kinds of terms and conditions of a small dollar loan product that ultimately can and would be decided by any individual institution that would apply for an individual no action letter under the template. And I think one thing I'll just stress there, that both the application and the no action letter template that was issued by the CFPB, none of that addresses, for example, the potential interest rate of the proposed product. Those are ultimately deferred for the details of an individual bank's product as part of the process of applying for a specific no action letter under the template. So again, and I just think it's useful to sort of think of this as establishing sort of a series of kind of mandatory terms and conditions, which are specified in the no action letter template, and then a series of other items which are left open for the individual institution to determine going forward. With that basic rubric in mind, let me just spend a few last minutes talking about the no action letter template itself that the BPI, that the Bank Policy Institute received. And again, very important to emphasize here that the no action letter template, it specifically addresses the application of UDAP to the described aspects of potential small dollar lending products. And the framework that's included in the no action letter template has two basic components. First, any applicant for a no action letter under the template has to provide a number of guardrail certifications that confirm that their product is consistent with that described in the template. And then second, for all the other kinds of key aspects of the product, they need to provide a range of supplemental information, clearly with the implication being that the CFPB would independently review and assess all of that supplemental information and evaluate it in terms of making a decision whether or not to actually grant a no action letter. I'll go over each of those categories quickly. In terms of the required guardrail certifications, if one were to pursue their own no action letter under the template, the first is status. In order to obtain a no action letter under the template, the applicant has to be an insured depository institution with assets over $10 billion. That's a function of the CFPB's supervisory authority. And again, since the whole point of getting a no action letter is some certainty around how the CFPB will exercise its supervisory and enforcement authority, it's necessarily limited to those institutions over which the CFPB has that direct authority. The product can only be offered to consumers who hold a deposit account with the applicant. As I mentioned, it needs to either be structured as a fixed-term small-dollar installment loan, where the customer would pay it back in fixed minimum amounts over time, or as an open-ended line of credit, withdrawals under that line of credit paid back in fixed amounts over time. The size of the product can't exceed $2,500. And then there are quite detailed specifications in terms of the repayment term and structure of the product. I won't go into that in too much detail because it is quite technical, but generally it contemplates repayment terms on the small dollar loan between 45 days and a year. With payments being amortized on a straight line basis across more than one payment. It requires a guardrail certification that no balloon payments will be required. It also requires a guardrail certification that rollovers of any type on the loan will be prohibited. And then last and importantly, I think it also requires a guardrail certification that no late payment fees or prepayment penalties will be charged with respect to the product. As I mentioned, there's a wide range of other aspects of the product that the template makes clear. The CFPB would expect an individual applicant to explain. That includes the APR, other kinds of fees, how it's mitigating the reborrowing risk associated with the product, how it's marketing the product and collecting applications. So a wide range of aspects of the product still left open and would need to be addressed in any application for a no action letter under the template and presumably subject to real scrutiny by the CFPB from a UDAP perspective for each of those things not specifically addressed in the no action letter template. I'll end with just a few other observations. The first is that although the no action letter template is bank centric, right, it quite clearly speaks to depository institutions. I do think it can be quite useful and relevant to non-banks, especially given the fact that it really does provide a sense of how the CFPB is likely to evaluate certain aspects of small dollar lending from a UDAP perspective. and what aspects of the product are likely to be most important to that analysis. And as you can tell from my overview, payment structure, clearly important. How reborrowing risks are mitigated, very important. And fee structures, very, very important. And again, I also think it's especially interesting and helpful in that it squarely addresses the application of small dollar credit products of the Dodd-Frank UDAP prohibition, you know, which I think in the pantheon of provisions that have caused regulatory uncertainty is certainly the highest when it comes to small dollar credit products. Again, just to be abundantly clear, the template itself doesn't provide any regulatory certainty on its own terms. An individual institution would still need to take additional steps to actually apply for and receive a no action letter, letter under the template, again, if it wanted to avail itself of that benefit in the form of a concise CFPB statement that they wouldn't pursue supervisory findings or a supervisory enforcement action. So that's the no action letter template in a nutshell. I know it's a lot of content, so we'll just take a few last minutes in case there are any questions. While we do that, I will go ahead and read off the CLE code. And I stress your capitalization matters. The CLE code is as follows. 4, lowercase g, as in giant, 9, 9. Again, that's 4, lowercase g, 9, 9. I'll read it one last time because I know it's important. So again, it's 4, lowercase g, as in giant, 9, 9. All right, very good. I know we're a few minutes past the half hour, so we'll take maybe just one or two questions. Bear with me as I pull these up. The first question, which I think I will toss to Eric, is around indeed the fact that most of what we talked about today pertains largely to banks. What lessons do you think you learned from these developments, non-banks that are active in the small dollar lending market? Eric, any thoughts on that?
Sure. Thanks, Jeremy. So I think the kinds of guardrails we've been discussing with regard to the template and otherwise apply with almost equal force to non-bank lenders. I think in particular, I think there'll always be a regulatory concern about the level of reborrowing. And so and the site, what was called by the Cordray administration, the cycle of debt. This is going to be especially true as people learn they can't dig out of the hole they were dug during the pandemic. The other bit of insight I'd pass on is that the regulatory uncertainty that the principals seek to correct for may receive a bit of a jolt this week because the CELA law case is going to be decided by the Supreme Court, and there's a real chance that they will rule that it's unconstitutional to limit the president's ability to terminate the CFPB director. If they do so, and there's a new president, neither of those things is assured, we could have a new direction from the Bureau as early as 7 or 8 months from now. So be on your guard.
Great. All right. Thanks, Eric. Seeing no other questions, and again, folks should feel free to reach out to us bilaterally after the fact. I'll just end with a little bit of final housekeeping. Again, as I mentioned at the start of our program, this is the lucky number 13 in our teleconference series. We've got a few more over the next couple of weeks, including a great presentation by our colleagues Mike Dinaka and Laith El-Hassani next week. They're going to give an update on implementation of the CARES Act, including the Federal Reserve loan programs and regulatory provisions, and a little bit of a look ahead in terms of potential future legislative developments around additional stimulus legislation. You can also find additional information about our financial services teleconference series on the events page of our website, health.gov.com, and on our COVID-19 toolkit page. Links to both of those should have been included in the meeting materials for today. So with that, thanks again for joining us today. We hope this has been useful and helpful. And if you've got any questions following the call, again, please feel free to reach out and with any questions that you might have. Thanks so much.